All right, welcome back, everyone. Today we're going on a deep dive into the great rivers of India.
Yeah, we're talking about the Ganga, the Yamuna, Brahmaputra, Godavari, Krishna, and Narmada.
And not just like, you know, their physical features on a map, but how these rivers have really shaped the whole civilization of India.
It's so interesting because we have all these sources, like ancient hymns, historical records, modern geographical analyses.
Right, and like what jumps out at me is how these rivers are so much more than just water in India.
Absolutely. It's this idea of sacred geography. Like in India, a river isn't just a river.
Okay, so it's not just like H2O flowing.
It's a deity. Like it's a source of purification.
Oh, wow.
It's a character in these epic myths.
So are we kind of saying that we're not just looking at the physical journey of these rivers, but also their spiritual journey?
Exactly.
Oh, I like that.
I take the Ganga, for example. You know, physically, it's an incredible journey. I mean, it starts from the Gangotri Glacier in the Himalayas.
Yeah, way up there.
Goes all the way to the Bay of Bengal.
Huge journey.
And creates this incredibly fertile plain along the way.
Yeah, that's the area where so much of India's agriculture happens.
Right? Absolutely. But it's also the goddess Ganga, you know, descended from heaven.
Oh, wow. Okay, so there's the physical river and then there's the goddess.
Yeah, and that myth, this idea of the goddess Ganga descending from heaven to purify the earth, that's at the heart of how millions of people view the river.
That is so different from how, at least in the West, we think about rivers.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a source of water. Maybe we go fishing or boating, but it's not this living entity that's intertwined with belief.
Exactly. And this is reflected in everything. From daily rituals to massive festivals like the Kumbh Mela. Have you heard of that?
Yes, I have. That's where millions of people bathe in the Ganga, right?
Yeah, for spiritual purification.
Yeah.
Now, flowing alongside the Ganga for a good portion is the Yamuna, major tributary, but it also has this totally separate identity.
So the Ganga's got its thing going on.
Yeah.
The Yamuna's like, no, no, I'm over here.
Oh, totally. A different personality, you could say.
I mean, I know the Yamuna is associated with Lord Krishna.
Yes.
Who, as many of you know, is one of the most popular deities in Hinduism. So does that association kind of show up in how people interact with the river?
Oh, absolutely. There are specific sites along the Yamuna that are associated with Krishna's childhood. Places of pilgrimage, places of celebration.
Oh, wow.
But you know what? The Yamuna is also, sadly, a very stark example of the challenges facing India's rivers today.
Okay.
It's incredibly polluted.
Really? Even though it's sacred?
Yeah. And it raises all these questions about how ancient reverence can exist alongside modern development.
That's a conflict I just never would have thought about. It's like, can you even maintain that sacred view when the physical reality of the river is so different?
It's a tension. And it plays out all across India.
Yeah.
Now, moving geographically, the Brahmaputra, another river with this really epic journey, starts in Tibet, cuts through the Himalayas.
Wow.
And then joins up with the Ganga in Bangladesh.
Oh.
Forming one of the largest deltas in the world.
That is a serious journey.
Mm.
And I know from what I've read that Assam, which is the region where the Brahmaputra flows in India, has a very distinct culture.
Yes.
And I'm just guessing, but the river plays a big role in that, doesn't it?
It's not just a river in Assam. It's like a lifeline. It's a source of identity.
Oh, wow.
So it's shaped their agriculture, their folklore, even their kind of unique position within India itself.
Mm-hmm.
There's this sense that the Brahmaputra sets them apart, connects them to the Himalayas in this way that the rest of India isn't.
Fascinating. So each of these rivers really does have its own story.
Yes.
It's not just the geography.
It's the personality.
And the personality, yeah.
Yeah.
And we've got three more to go.
We do.
The Godavari, Krishna, and Narmada, they all flow westward, right?
Across the Deccan Plateau.
Deccan Plateau.
Yeah. They might be less famous globally, but they're really crucial for understanding India.
What strikes me is how each of these rivers seems tied to a specific region, you know?
Yeah.
And they're not just shaping the land, but also the culture of the people who live there.
Absolutely.
Like, take the Godavari.
Yeah.
It's the Ganges of the South.
Yeah, because of its size, because of the reverence that it holds in that region.
Okay. And what about the Narmada? What's special about it?
The Narmada is unusual. Because it flows westward, unlike most of the major Indian rivers.
Okay.
And it's considered incredibly sacred. It's tied to Shiva in Hindu mythology.
Wow. So every river has its own mythology, its own set of stories. It's almost like they were creating these bonds between people and the land and their beliefs for centuries. Mm. And now I'm really starting to see how these rivers weren't just these passive features on the landscape. They were really active forces in shaping how Indian civilization emerged.
That's a great point, and it leads to something really important. These rivers weren't just background noise. They were catalysts.
Okay.
They were catalysts for ancient cities, for trade routes, for religious practices.
Oh, wow.
They shaped how people lived. They shaped where people settled. They shaped how they understood the world around them.
Okay, I'm totally intrigued now. Tell me more. Like, how do these rivers become such dynamic forces? I mean, they really shaped everything.
Well, we kind of have to go back to the beginning. We have to go back to the Indus-Sarasvati civilization, one of the world's earliest urban societies.
Okay, so we're talking way, way back.
Thousands of years ago, and these rivers, they were central.
For them to even exist.
Absolutely. In fact, there's even evidence that a now dried up river, the Hakra River, might have been a key factor in the rise of those early Harappan cities.
Wait, so even rivers that don't exist anymore have left their mark on history. That's fascinating. But how did these rivers actually, like, help these civilizations grow? Was it all about having water for crops?
It was about so much more than just irrigation. These rivers, they were like the highways of ancient India. They connected different regions. They facilitated trade. They allowed for ideas and goods to flow back and forth. Imagine, like, long before paved roads, before trains, these rivers were the most efficient way to move goods, to move people across vast distances.
So they were shaping the physical landscape.
Yeah.
They were shaping the cultural landscape.
Yeah.
They were shaping the economic landscape. I mean, they really were like the veins and arteries of this ancient civilization, just pumping life and energy into every corner of the subcontinent.
That's a great analogy. And don't forget about irrigation. Irrigation was key. India's huge agricultural population, it wouldn't have been possible without these rivers. They allowed for crops to be cultivated on this massive scale, and that supported the growth of empires, the growth of cities. Think about the Gangetic Plain, one of the most densely populated regions of the world even today.
It's incredible.
That fertility, that ability to support so many people, it's tied directly to the Ganga.
So it's like these rivers had this ripple effect.
Absolutely.
You know, like, it's where people settled. It's how they structured their societies. Did these rivers influence things like, you know, specific communities developing?
Yeah.
Or even social hierarchies?
Absolutely. Settlements naturally developed along riverbanks. Riverine trade, you know, the trade along the rivers, that was huge for the development of the merchant community, the mercantile community. You had groups like boatmen or fishermen. Their livelihoods completely depended on these rivers. And those economic realities, they often translated into social structures.
It's almost like we can see the flow of history itself just by following the course of these rivers.
Yeah.
Which makes that idea of sacred geography that you were talking about.
Yeah.
Even more powerful. It's like the physical and the spiritual are so closely intertwined in India. But, you know, it also raises a question for me. We've been talking about how people revered these rivers, but how did that reverence actually show itself? Was it just about myths and stories? Or was it something more?
Oh, it was so much more than stories. These rivers were woven into every aspect of life. I mean, from those daily rituals to those grand festivals that we talked about, think about pilgrimage.
Okay.
Millions of people journey to the source of the Ganga.
Huh.
Or they bathe in its waters at sacred sites like Varanasi.
Yeah.
That's not just tourism.
No.
That's a deeply spiritual act.
Right.
It's a physical manifestation of their belief in the river's purifying power.
So it's like the river is more than just a story. It's like this lived experience.
Yeah.
It's this connection to something sacred.
And it's not just these big acts of pilgrimage. It's the daily things.
Yeah.
People offer prayers to the rivers. They do these ceremonies on the banks of the rivers. They even use the river water in purification rituals in their homes. It's
yes.
So woven into the fabric of daily life.
So the river's not just out there. It's in their homes. It's in their rituals. It's like their whole way of thinking. It's really different from how we often see the relationship between nature and humans.
And that difference, that's what makes this so fascinating. But it also leads to some serious challenges. How do you keep that reverence when you've got pollution? How do you balance these ancient beliefs with the needs of a growing modern population?
Yeah, that's a huge question. I mean, is it even possible to hold on to those beliefs when the river itself is struggling?
That tension, that struggle, that's at the heart of what we're exploring.
Mm-hmm.
How does a civilization that's built around these sacred rivers navigate the 21st century? How do they do it?
This is way more than I expected. I can't wait to hear more.
Well, let's get into some specific examples then.
Okay, let's do it.
Because the story of each river and how it's being impacted, it's unique.
Okay.
So let's start with the Ganga itself. You know the Ganga? It's almost like this microcosm of all the challenges these rivers face. On one hand, you have this deep reverence, millions of people relying on it, you know, for agriculture, for daily life. You even have government initiatives like the Namami Gange program. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, I was curious about that. I mean, from what I understand, it's this huge effort to try and clean up the river. They're tackling sewage treatment, industrial pollution, the whole thing.
That's massive. But it kind of highlights the complexities. Because you're trying to apply these modern solutions to a river that's so deeply connected to tradition, to belief, even to politics. There are economic interests, religious practices, just ingrained habits that are really, really hard to change overnight.
So it's not just a technical problem, it's also a cultural problem.
Exactly. And the Yamuna, well, it faces even bigger issues. It's probably the most polluted of India's major rivers.
Wow.
And this is despite it being sacred to millions. You've got court rulings, you've got activism, you've got religious leaders calling for its protection, and yet the pollution just continues.
You know, when I was looking at the research for this, it was interesting. Some scholars argue that the Yamuna's pollution, it's almost like a reflection of modern India itself. This struggle to balance rapid development with these traditional values.
That's a really interesting point. It's like the river becomes this mirror reflecting the tensions of a society that's going through this huge transition. Now, Brahmaputra, it's a different story. Here, it's less about pollution and more about just managing its power. I mean, we're talking about a river that's prone to massive flooding, impacting millions of people in Assam and Bangladesh.
Oh, yeah. I remember reading about those devastating floods in Assam, how entire villages can get swept away. It's a reminder of just how powerful nature is and how even with all of our technology, we're still pretty vulnerable.
And that vulnerability, it's made worse by deforestation and climate change. These are making those floods more unpredictable, more severe. It's like we have to remember that these rivers, they're not static, they change. And our actions, they have a direct impact on those changes.
It's like we're playing this game with nature, this really high-stakes game.
Hi.
But the rules, they're always changing. What about the Godavari, the Krishna, and the Narmada? Those rivers that flow westward, do they have similar problems?
They have their own unique challenges. The Godavari, for instance, it's facing this increasing water stress because of growing populations and agricultural demands. It's classic overuse. This resource that was once considered plentiful is now being stretched to its limits.
Right. And I was reading about how some farmers along the Godavari are even having trouble getting enough water for their crops.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, new industries are popping up and needing more and more water. It's like that tension between tradition and development is playing out again, just in a different way.
Exactly. And the Krishna, which flows through a really heavily industrialized region, well, it faces similar challenges. And then you have the Narmada, which is caught up in this whole other conflict. It's about damming its waters for power and irrigation.
Oh, yeah, that Narmada Dam project.
Yeah.
It's so controversial. It's got environmentalists against development advocates, indigenous communities against the government. It's like the river itself has become this battleground, this battleground for these competing visions of progress.
It's a powerful example of how these rivers, they're so much more than just waterways. They're sites of conflict. They're symbols of identity. They're even political pawns in a much larger game. And it brings us back to that question we've been wrestling with. How do you balance the needs of people with the needs of the environment, the demands of the present with the legacy of the past?
It feels overwhelming to me sometimes. I mean, are there even any answers?
I don't know if there are easy answers, but there are people working towards solutions. And I think the first step is just understanding, you know, recognizing that these rivers are more than just lines on a map. They're part of this living system, a system that we're all part of.
So like a shift in how we see things, seeing these rivers not as something to be used up, but as partners in this journey that we're all on.
That's it. And that shift has to include the cultural and spiritual dimensions as well. The reverence that Indians have for their rivers, even though it sometimes clashes with development, it can be a powerful force for conservation.
It's like that sacred geography idea again. You see a river as a deity, as something sacred. Well, you're probably not going to pollute it. You're going to treat it with respect.
Right. And there are examples all over India where communities are using those traditional beliefs to protect their rivers. They're organizing cleanup drives, advocating for sustainable practices, even bringing back ancient water harvesting methods.
So it's not just about bringing in new solutions from the outside. It's also about realizing that traditional wisdom can be a part of the answer, too.
Absolutely. And that's where I see some hope. It's in those communities, in those individuals who are trying to bridge that gap, the gap between ancient reverence and modern needs. They're finding ways to honor the past while building a more sustainable future.
It's like they're taking threads of tradition and threads of innovation and weaving them together,
yeah,
creating this new tapestry of hope for India's rivers.
That's a beautiful image, and it reminds us that even when we're faced with these huge challenges, there's always the potential for human ingenuity, for resilience, to find a way forward.
This has been quite a journey. We've gone from the Himalayas to the Gangetic Plain, from ancient myths to modern-day problems and solutions. It's amazing.
It has been a remarkable journey. And, you know, we've really just scratched the surface, this topic. It's so vast and complex.
But even in this short time, it's clear that these rivers are so much more than just waterways. They're lifelines, they're deities, they're symbols, they're battlegrounds. And in the end, they're a reflection of ourselves, our relationship with nature, our relationship with each other.
And as we face the challenges of this century, I think there's a really important lesson to learn from these rivers, a lesson about the power of place, about understanding different perspectives, about finding that harmony between humanity and nature.
This deep dive has been eye-opening. It really has. It's given me a lot to think about. But before we finish up, I have one last question. We've talked about the problems. I'm curious, what do you see as the biggest opportunity? Where is there room for hope, for positive change?
It really has been. And it's true. We've only just started to kind of peek into this whole world of how India's rivers and its civilization are so connected.
You know, one thing that I keep coming back to is how these rivers are almost like characters in India's story. They've seen empires rise and fall. They've inspired so many myths and legends, and they're still shaping the lives of millions of people today.
And that story is still being written. We talked about all the challenges, the pollution, the overuse, climate change. But even amidst all of that, there are these glimmers of hope.
You mentioned earlier about how some communities are drawing on traditional beliefs to protect their rivers. Mm-hmm. Do you have any specific examples that really stand out?
One that comes to mind is the Bishnoi community. They're in Rajasthan. And they have this centuries-old tradition of environmental conservation. And it's all rooted in their religious beliefs. They're known for fiercely protecting trees, wildlife, and they even have rituals that involve offering water to the earth. It's a really beautiful example of how ancient wisdom can be this powerful force for sustainability.
That's amazing. It's like sometimes the solutions we're looking for are already there.
Yeah.
Right in front of us, like hidden in plain sight.
Exactly. And it's not just about preserving the past. It's about taking those traditions and adapting them for today's world. There's this growing movement in India to revive ancient water harvesting techniques, things like stepwells and johads.
I've seen pictures of those. They're incredible.
They are. And they're so effective at capturing rainwater and recharging groundwater, which is so important in a country that's facing water scarcity.
So it's like this blend of old and new, taking that traditional knowledge and combining it with modern technology to create a more sustainable future.
Exactly. And it goes beyond just the technical stuff. It's also about shifting how we think, about fostering a deeper appreciation for how everything is interconnected. You know, there's this ancient Indian concept, Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam.
I've heard that. What does it mean?
It means the whole world is one family. And it speaks to this idea that everything is connected. And if we truly embrace that idea, then caring for our rivers, caring for our environment, well, it becomes an act of caring for ourselves, caring for our family, caring for the generations that come after us.
That's a beautiful way to think about it. And it brings us right back to what we've been talking about today. These rivers aren't just waterways. They're lifelines. They're deities. They're mm-hmm. symbols of a culture that is deeply connected to nature.
And they remind us that the health of our planet and the health of our cultures, our beliefs, our spiritual well-being, they're all tied together. We can't separate them.
That's a really powerful message.
Yeah.
Something I'll definitely be thinking about as I continue to learn more about this. It's been a truly enlightening conversation.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you so much for being here. And to all our listeners out there, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the great rivers of India. We'll be back next time with another fascinating topic, another journey into the heart of human experience. Until then, keep exploring, keep learning, and keep those rivers flowing.